Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock, and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on Monday, the 26th of September, the year 2011. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Amy Skilbert and Zoe Morrison about Juneau's climate action plan. Amy Gulick will be here to give us a preview of her presentation tomorrow night, highlighting her book, Salmon in the Trees. We'll talk to Pua Maunu about visiting local artists in their studios this month or next month, and Tom Matisse will be here to review lessons learned during last week's Disaster Preparedness Expo. We'll also hear the Writer's Almanac, Bird Note Music, and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight looks like cloudy skies with a chance of rain, low temperatures around 41 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain and high temperatures around 53 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Members of the Cherokee Nation went to the polls Saturday to elect a new leader. KGOU's Kirk Gortney reports.
Election officials with the Cherokee Nation say voting Saturday was a smooth process. Tribal citizens voted for the second time to elect their next principal chief, but it will be at least October 10th before anyone will know the results of the election. A recent court order added extra voting days for the descendants of former slaves of the Cherokee people called freedmen through October 8th. Election Commission Chairwoman Susan Plum said higher in-person turnout for the weekend race shows tribal citizens still have faith in the election process. The second election was needed after the Cherokee Nation Supreme Court decided the first election for chief was too close to call. The Election Commission says preliminary figures show more than 8,700 ballots were cast during Saturday's election, with another 1,100 coming during an early voting period. The ballots are now locked up with officers of the Cherokee Nation Marshal Service providing security until the counting can begin October 8th, with the announcement of the winner expected 48 hours later. For National Native News, I'm Kurt Gwartney.
A new report shows Alaska Native children in rural areas have more than four times the dental decay than others in the U.S. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services conducted the study. KDLG's Daisha Eaton has more.
The report is based on a 2008 investigation into dental decay in rural Alaska. Brad Whistler is the dental officer with the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services and was one of the investigators for the study. He says the study found that lack of water fluoridation and too much soda pop consumption were two key factors associated with dental decay severity in both baby and adult teeth.
When they compared children living in fluoridated versus non-fluoridated villages, they found less severe dental decay in children living in fluoridated villages. And then the final point that's touched on in the report, they found increased dental decay as Alaska Native children consume more soda pop.
The CDC investigation was requested by the department on behalf of the region due to the extent and severity of the dental decay in Native children. The investigation consisted of screening 348 children ages 4 through 15 for dental decay. Parents were also surveyed on factors suspected to influence decay. According to the report, approximately 400 children under 6 years of age in the study region had extraction and/or restoration of multiple teeth with cavities. Whistler says the study had two conclusions.
The real work that the Native corporations are working on is to reduce the level of disease in the population. This highlights that water fluoridation is one of the ways they might do that in villages that have the capacity to implement fluoridation. And the second part is it also highlights the role of diet in terms of watching the amount of sugar and sweetened beverages that young children are consuming.
Numerous national and international studies have documented the role of water fluoridation in reducing dental decay. However, this is the first such study in Alaska. In Dillingham, I'm Daisha Eaton.
In Canada, people are flocking to Parliament Hill to protest TransCanada's Keystone XL pipeline project. The plan is to ship oil from Canadian tar sands in Alberta to U.S. refineries in the Gulf of Mexico. According to the CBC, hundreds of protesters have already gathered in Ottawa this morning. First Nations people are among those expected to participate, including the Dene Nation. Native leaders say the pipeline threatens their water usage and it would increase pollution and impact climate change. In August, people protested and were arrested in front of the White House. President Obama will make the final decision on the pipeline project. During this month in 1794, eight Russian Orthodox monks arrived in Kodiak, Alaska. They taught their faith to Native people in the region and established a church. This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
If you are a Native American who experienced discrimination from the USDA while trying to get a farm loan, you could get a payment of up to $50,000 or more. There will be meetings in locations around the country between July and December 2011 where you can get free legal help filing a claim. More details and a full schedule of meetings is available at IndianFarmClass.com or 1-888-233-5506.
Native Voice 1, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:05 and you are tuned in to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. First guests are Zoe Morrison and also Amy Skilbert here to talk about the Climate Action Plan. Thank you very much for coming into the station, everybody.
Yeah, thank you. It's great to be here.
Thank you.
So what is the Climate Action Plan? My first big question.
Yeah, the Climate Action Plan, we are working on it with the City and Borough of Juneau. In about 2007, they did the first greenhouse gas inventory. And I think it was 2009 that the City and Borough of Juneau Assembly adopted steps that they would be taking to try and reduce greenhouse gases in Juneau, including greenhouse gas inventory, a climate action plan, targets for reducing greenhouse gases, and then measuring the implementation of actions from a climate action plan to reduce greenhouse gases, where they would end up.
What are some sample greenhouse gases?
Greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide and nitrous oxide, sulfur.
Mm-hmm. And the first draft was released when?
And methane, sorry. The first draft of the Climate Action Plan, we had a meeting on that in, I think, Zoe, was that in May? May 25th or so.
And what was the reaction?
There were several people who took part not only in giving comments, but also looking at the different actions that we presented and giving us some feedback on how important they thought those were, or whether they thought we were missing some. And generally, people had a positive reaction to it and gave us some good feedback on things we might have been missing. So.
What are some of the things that might be happening?
So the Climate Action Plan sets out a greenhouse gas reduction target of 25% by the year 2032, so in about 25 years, and it sets out actions to meet that target. Most of the actions are focused on two sectors, transportation and building, because those are the sectors that produce the most greenhouse gas emissions and use the most energy here in Juneau. So the plan provides specific actions around those two sectors.
Such as
improving the public transit system so that people have a good option for driving less?
One of the things that we've been pretty certain of and that came out in some of the work that we were doing is economics are going to drive a lot of decisions that people make. When gasoline is over $4 a gallon, people may decide and have been deciding to drive less. When we have good weather in the summer, things like taking a bicycle to work instead of driving your car. And the economics of it is how much does it cost you to do the things that you have done in the past, and what can you do to decrease your energy use, either by or basically just conserving energy and not using as much. Some of the programs that are ongoing in Juneau and in Alaska includes the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation working with individuals to help them weatherize their homes in order to reduce the overall energy that they use. And Alaska Housing Finance has a payback for that, if you will, that if you are able to reduce your energy use a certain amount and reduce your greenhouse gas emissions, then they support the cost of the work that you've done up to about $10,000. So these are the sorts of things that we're looking at as things that people are already doing, what businesses might do, what government entities are doing and might do more of, things like how much insulation there should be in houses, what are the standards that should be used going forward to ensure that we conserve energy even in those areas where we have to use it for heating homes, things like that.
Well, developing the plan, did you look at other communities?
We certainly did. We many communities have been working on climate action planning, and so there are lots of good examples of communities that are similar climate to Juneau and similar size to Juneau that we looked at, and we've taken, where appropriate, we've taken some actions and examples from those plans.
Yeah. For example, Homer has done a climate action plan, and we looked at what Homer has done. We looked at Boulder, Colorado.
White Horse,
Canada, and then there's Evanston, Illinois. There's a couple others. So.
Of course, Evanston, Illinois.
Why not?
I guess the reason I ask that is because there may be some ideas out there that, you know, nobody here in Juneau has thought of yet.
Absolutely. And we aren't the first community to do a climate action plan. And so taking advantage of what has gone before in other communities and the plans that they've written and what action items they've recommended, and for some of them, how successful those have been even.
Have you taken into account the variabilities of human behavior? Unless some people just won't recycle no matter what they or they won't take the trouble to recycle perhaps as much as they should.
Right. Well, with all the actions that we've recommended, we don't expect 100% of people to take all those actions. So some actions are what people can take individually, others businesses, others government. And we looked at, in order to reach some of the emissions target reductions, what are the different choices that people might make? And whereas you might not want to recycle, you may be willing to ride a bike to work when it's sunny out because that's you want to. So,
on October 5th, there's going to be a second round of public comments?
That's right. There's a second public meeting. It's next Wednesday, so October 5th from 5:30 to 7:30 at the Mendenhall Public Library. And we'll be reviewing the latest draft of the plan and the implementation actions. We'll be focusing on what we think are the most important actions for both the community and the city and borough of Juneau, and we're hoping that people come and give us some input and feedback on what we have so far.
What are those important actions?
Well,
there are several of them. Some of the top ones include, for buildings, trying to reduce the energy use and GHG emissions in residential and commercial buildings. Similarly to what I just talked about with the Alaska Housing Finance, how do you make your building a more energy efficient, whether it's your house or whether it's your office? What are the things that you can do to improve your energy consumption so that you decrease it? Things like maybe setting up an awards program for businesses and commercial building owners to give some examples to the community where people and businesses are actually reducing energy use, and evaluating possible government incentives that could help increase that transition to more efficient energy use in our community.
Also, the draft plan as well as those top actions are available on our website at Scheinberg Associates. You can find it easily by going to the City and Borough of Juneau website at juneau.org and following the links under Hot Topics.
And what's the timeline for all this?
So we're having the meeting next week, and then we'll be meeting subsequently with the Committee of the Whole on October 31st. And after that, we'll be looking to finalize the plan. And then through November, there'll be, or towards the end of November, there'll be a public hearing. That'll be part of the formal adoption process of this plan.
But the number one thing is to try and get people to attend the meeting on October 5th from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m., and it's at the Mendenhall Public Library. So we're looking for people to participate.
If people can't make the meeting but still would like to pony up their 2 cents, how can they do that?
Just like Zoe had said, through the website. Go to the juneau.org, and you can also reach either of us through an email through the website as well.
And I've been talking to Amy Skilbert and Zoe Morrison about the Climate Action Plan. Remember, going to the annual, or the, not the annual meeting, the meeting on October 5th, the Mendenhall Valley Library. Is that at 5:30?
5:30, correct.
Anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask?
No, I think that's it. Thank you.
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you.
Evergreen. Amazon is calling.
Help the planet Earth.
With voices from the jungle.
Help the planet Earth.
Hear the tree that's falling.
Help the planet Earth.
Rainforests are crying.
Help the planet Earth. Up to me, it's up to you. Ocean's wave is rumbling. Help the planet Earth.
With voices from the sea wave.
Help the planet Earth.
Water's for the drinking.
Help the planet Earth.
Beluga whales are singing. Help this planet Earth. It's up to you. Right now is when we're needed. We can all do something. The young, the old, together. 'Cause the more we get together, the more we help this planet Earth. So come on, United Nations. Children of one mother,
help the planet Earth.
With love for one another, yeah.
Help the planet Earth.
For our sons and daughters' future,
help this planet Earth
to stay ever clean, ever blue, as it was in the beginning. We've got to see it through. It's up to you.
Help this planet Earth.
It's ever green and ever blue.
Help this planet Earth.
It's up to me. It's up to you.
Help this planet Earth.
It's ever green and ever
help
blue.
And you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest is author and photographer Amy Gulick here. She's talking about her new book, Salmon in the Trees, which came out last year. Is that correct, Amy?
Yes.
And you have a presentation tomorrow at the Juneau Arts Culture Center. A photo show and exhibit opens at 5:30, and then the presentation itself starts at 7 o'clock. Amy, thanks again for being on the show with me today.
Oh, you bet.
So the title of the book, Salmon in the Trees, refers to a natural biological process. You want to elaborate on that, please?
Sure. So scientists have actually found evidence of salmon in trees and this beautiful connection between the forests and the salmon here in Southeast Alaska goes something like this. So when the salmon are spawning, they leave the ocean and they enter their birth streams. They're bringing marine nutrients with them in their bodies. And there are lots of hungry animals waiting for them, in particular lots of bears around here. And so the bears will pluck the salmon from the streams, drag and drop them into the forest. Other animals scavenge on them. This spreads these marine nutrients all throughout the forest. And over time, the nutrients decompose, filter down into the soil and the trees and other vegetation, then absorb them through their roots. And scientists have actually been able to trace this marine nitrogen, it's called nitrogen-15, in trees near salmon streams that they can link back to the fish.
What inspired the book?
For me, it was that connection. I read this very dry scientific article somewhere that talked about this connection, and it just kind of hit me like a truck. I just thought, wow. I mean, if I could help people understand that one amazing connection, then they would understand what makes all of Southeast Alaska what it is.
Would you call it a political book?
No, not at all. Well, the book definitely focuses on the Tongass National Forest, because 80% of Southeast Alaska is the Tongass, and there are more than 4,000 salmon spawning streams throughout the Tongass, so you really can't talk about salmon in the trees here without also talking about the Tongass. But I was very adamant that I didn't want to tell the story of what's wrong with the Tongass. I think that story's been told many times. I really wanted to tell the story of what's right with the Tongass. So my book is definitely a celebration of not only the connection between salmon and trees and the wildlife and all the wonderful things in nature here, but it's also a celebration of the people here and their way of life as well.
The book itself is a collection of really amazing photographs and some pretty amazing essays at the same time. What kind of thread ties them all together?
That's a great question. Salmon. It's when I was traveling all throughout Southeast Alaska when I was working on the book, there were definitely some very specific areas I needed to get to. I spent time in a lot of the communities throughout Southeast Alaska. And each community is very different from one another. They each have their own personalities. Again, just kind of a different feel to it. And some are like kind of night and day from one another. But out of all the communities I traveled to, the one thing that binds people here to Southeast is salmon. It's just kind of like this beautiful thread that weaves throughout not only the forest and the ocean, but through people's lives as well.
Now, this being a radio show, people can't see that you're wearing a T-shirt by Ray Troll, one of the contributors of the book himself. Can you want to talk about some of the contributors?
Sure. So in addition to Ray Troll, we also have Richard Nelson. He recorded a beautiful audio CD that's included in the book. John Straley, mystery novel writer from Sitka, contributed an essay. Juno naturalist Richard Carstensen, Sea Alaska Heritage Institute President Rosita Worrell wrote the Native chapter. And then throughout the book, we have profiles of people who live and work here in Southeast Alaska. I think there's 11 different profiles from people from all different communities and that do different things for a living.
How long did it take you to put the book together?
From start to finish, from the day I started making the photograph to the day I actually held it in my hand was 3 years. And I liken it to being pregnant for 3 years and then finally giving birth to this book.
It being a square kind of object, that must have been tough. What to you is the biggest challenge salmon face?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there are so many challenges that salmon face. I actually live in Washington State, and we used to have just unbelievable, bountiful salmon runs. The Columbia River system and its tributaries were the largest salmon-producing system in the entire world. 2 to 16 million salmon would spawn in that system every year, and I think now we're just at 2%. Of those levels. There are many, many factors down there in the lower 48 that have contributed to salmon's demise, damming the rivers, overfishing, clear-cut logging, right down to the banks. That causes erosion and all kinds of other habitat fragmentation. I think up here, global climate change, who knows what that's going to do to salmon. Salmon are very sensitive to water temperature, very sensitive to water levels in the creeks and the water levels and the timing of all of that. The water has to be, a certain temperature and kind of a certain height at just the right time for the salmon to be able to spawn. So, again, climate change will probably play a big role in affecting the future of salmon here. And I think maybe, it's just people's awareness. If we don't understand what salmon need to thrive, that they need both the ocean and their birth streams that, weave throughout the forest here. If we're not aware of what they need, then when we do start doing development activities or whether it's logging or mining or recreation, building facilities or something along salmon streams, if we're not aware of what they need, then that could definitely be a threat to salmon as well.
I mentioned earlier the amazing photographs in the book, Salmon in the Trees by Amy Gulick, who's in the studio with me today. And those pictures themselves, your eye to gill with some of these fish, and it's an amazing picture. Do you have any advice for people who want to take similar pictures or pictures of nature in particular?
Just be prepared to spend a lot of time out there and have a lot of patience. But it's amazing, especially here in Southeast Alaska. At certain times of the year, you know, if you're willing to spend, you know, a few days, maybe a week or so, just kind of hanging out on salmon streams or out in the ocean, say, watching for whales, this place will deliver. You don't really even have to wait long. I'm a person who don't, I really don't have a lot of patience. but, you know, you come here during salmon time and, all the creeks are filled and bears are all over the place and eagles and ravens. And it's just an amazing, amazing place. I always kind of liken it to, you know, you're kind of in the middle of this fantastic concert and you've got front row seats, you know, to the best show on earth.
Even though the book is called Salmon in the Trees, the most memorable photo for me is the bear in the tree.
Yeah, the bear in the tree with the salmon in its mouth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that was pretty neat. And that's, you know, it's funny because people see that picture and they think, oh, well, that's salmon in the trees, right? It's just like when the bears or the eagles actually carry the salmon up into the trees. And I tell people, no, that's salmon up a tree. You know, there are actually salmon in the trees.
You're talking tomorrow night at, there's a show of your work tomorrow night at 5:30 at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center, and then at 7 o'clock you'll be making a presentation. Can you tell me about the presentation, please?
Yeah, I'll be giving my full slideshow presentation that I've been giving all throughout Southeast Alaska this summer, and it's there's probably more than 200 photographs I'll show, and basically I'll talk about my journey, what it was like to travel all throughout Southeast Alaska, people I met along the way, bear encounters, you know, watching for whales, meeting native folks and learning about their culture, just kind of, a real fun kind of adventure travelogue of my journey throughout Southeast Alaska looking for salmon in the trees.
There's a movie there somewhere, Bear Encounters of the Third Kind, I think. And will there be time for questions and answers at the end of your presentation?
Oh, you bet. You bet.
What's been the reaction from the people in general? You've delivered this thing a couple of times, I understand.
Mm-hmm. You know, I was a little worried about how people in Southeast might react to the book. You know, there are plenty of books made on Southeast Alaska, and many of them are geared towards tourists. And while I certainly want people outside of Alaska to learn about this amazing place, I really, again, wanted to celebrate not only Southeast Alaska and its incredible natural wonders, but I really wanted to celebrate the people here and their way of life. And you never really know if you kind of pull that off or not until you get some feedback from people. But so far, this is, Juneau's the sixth stop on a Southeast Alaskan tour of the exhibit, and I've had nothing really but incredible positive feedback from Southeasters.
Well, it's an incredible positive book.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
I have been talking to Amy Gulick. She wrote a book, Salmon in the Trees. We could have a photo show and exhibit starting at 5:30 tomorrow night at the Juneau Arts and Culture Center, followed at 7 o'clock by a presentation. You could have books available for sale?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And how much does it cost?
I believe retail is $29.95.
All right, Amy, thank you very much for coming by. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I think that's it. You covered it.
Is the Writer's Almanac for Monday. It's the 26th of September, 2011. Today is the European Day of Languages, a yearly event started about 10 years ago. Celebrate human language, encourage language learning, and bring attention to the importance of being multilingual in this polyglot world. It's the birthday of T.S. Eliot, Thomas Stearns Eliot, born 1888, St. Louis, Missouri, where he spent the first 18 years of his life. He was a smart, hard-working young man, went off to Harvard, finished his undergraduate work and master's degree in just 4 years, started writing poetry at the same time. He was going to get a Ph.D. in philosophy under visiting Professor Bertrand Russell. But he went off traveling to Germany, then a year at Oxford. World War I broke out, so he couldn't come back to complete the degree. In England, he became acquainted with Ezra Pound, who became his mentor and critic. And Eliot shared with Pound a long poem he'd begun in college, he'd finished 3 years before, which Pound encouraged Eliot to publish. And it came out in 1915, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock. in Poetry magazine. The same year, he met a very pretty young writer, Vivian Haywood, and in just 3 months, they were married. Bertrand Russell offered to help the young couple. They settled down in his apartment in London. Russell introduced T.S. Eliot to other writers. He lent the couple money. And almost immediately after their marriage, the Eliots discovered that they were incompatible. And it seems that Mrs. Eliot began an affair with Bertrand Russell about that time. In 1921, exhausted, suffering from overwork and marital problems, T.S. Eliot had a nervous breakdown. He went off to a sanatorium to recuperate, and it was there that he finished his long poem, The Wasteland. In 1933, T.S. Eliot began the process of legal separation from Vivian. He tried to avoid all contact with her, and she refused to accept that. She became panicky and depressed. One day she was found wandering through London at 5 o'clock in the morning, confused, asking passers-by if her husband had been beheaded, and she was committed to an institution. And it's the birthday of the philosopher and literary critic Martin Heidegger, born 1889 in Messkirk, Germany. Came from a lower-class family, one of the few philosophers of his century to have come from peasant stock. Martin Heidegger served in the German army in World War I and became a teacher. And through World War II, he was a keen supporter of the Nazi movement and refused to recant his sympathy for Nazi philosophy or for his party membership. On into the 1950s, he was still reprinting lectures he'd given in the 30s on the greatness of the Nazis. Heidegger's main philosophical interest was ontology, the study of being, and his most important work, Being and Time, 1927. Other people associated him with the French existentialist movement, but Heidegger himself said he was not. Here's a poem for today by David Budbill, September Visitors. I'm glad to see our friends come, talk, laughter, food, wine. I'm glad to see our friends go. Solitude, emptiness, gardens, autumn wind. September Visitors, a poem by David Budbill, from Happy Life, published by Copper Canyon Press and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac, supported by Constant Contact, combining the power of email marketing and social media for more customers and more time back on your clock. ConstantContact.com. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923, innovative developer of diabetes treatments and delivery devices at novonordisk-us.com. Produced by Kathy Roach, written by Priscilla Kinter. Be well, do good work, keep in touch.
Broadcast support comes from McDonald's, now serving caramel apple sundaes and parfaits. McDonald's is open daily in the valley on Trout Street.
Time is 3:33, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau, where our next guests are Sarah Conroe and Pua Mauno here to talk about Artists Open Studios and Workspaces, which is happening in October, starting all at the Franklin Street Gallery during Gallery Walk. Pua and Sarah, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
So, Pua, you want to tell us about this idea, how did it come about?
Okay, this is Juno's first open studio, and the idea came about when I was in San Francisco probably about, I don't know, 7 or 8 years ago. I went to visit the artist that taught me how to paint, and it just so happened that the gallery that he works out of, which is a community gallery, had this open studio, and it was filled with different artists' work, and the concept was that there was one piece of every artist that wanted to participate, and throughout the month of October, you could go and visit different artists' studios throughout San Francisco and Bay Area. I thought it was pretty cool.
What was it like going into somebody else's house, and I mentioned what it was like for them as artists to open up their studios?
Mm-hmm. There are pockets of artists, and you know, They're all different kinds. I mean, basically, you know, some had small studios that, and some even worked off of their kitchen tables. And then there are some artist pockets where they're a collection of different artists within one studio space that created work. It was really interesting.
How does it work in Juneau?
Well, it's going to take place throughout the month of October. Basically, we're going to have a gala kickoff at the Franklin Street Gallery, which is at the Baranoff Hotel, and that's going to be on October 7th. It's in conjunction with First Friday with all the gallery walks, and there's going to be about 30 to 35 artists represented. All of their works will be, one work from every artist will be hung on the walls at the Franklin Street Gallery, and there people will be able to pick up a brochure which has a listing of all the artists' open studios, dates and times. And also artists will have individual cards talking about their studio. And so people can take those and pick and choose which they want to visit. And it will take place throughout the month of October. There's no specific area that's where, like, on one Saturday it will be all Douglas, but it's going to be different areas. But basically the artists are planning to have it in the afternoon on Saturdays and Sundays in October, so the people who are interested can better plan out their days to go to the studio, or their day to go to different studios.
So like it's not going to be like at midnight somebody's knocking on the door and say, hey, can I come in?
Yeah, that would be bad, I think, although some artists may still be awake at that time doing artwork.
Sarah, was it Sarah Connor, or you're one of the artists involved in this? Was it hard to make up your mind to let people into your space?
No, I mean, I am excited about opening up my space. My space is in my home, so I wasn't nervous about opening it up, but it is a motivation to clean my house maybe a little more. But I think it's a really lovely idea, and it's I just, you know, for example, I just actually met Pua right before this interview, whereas I already knew her name and her work for a number of years in town. So even just the connectivity between artists is really fun, and to kind of get a chance to check out how they work, I feel free and open to offer that in exchange to put my head in their world too.
Must be interesting with seeing the creativity in that, or how the space inspires the creativity.
Yeah, I mean, definitely the few people that I've gotten to see just socially, you know, we all have the style kind of goes, you know, creeps into your space. So it'll be fun to make that connection.
Pua, what are some of the artists involved?
I have a
list them all off if you want to.
Okay, I have a list. And okay, Constance Baltuk, Mustafa Bea, Kaylin Butner Burke, Sarah Canaro, Barbara Craver, Sarah Dunlap, Basement Studios with Lincoln Farabee and Tasha Wallen, Jim Fowler, Mary Ellen Frank, Dan Fruits, John Hughes with Raven Song Studios, and there's a collection of artists in that studio in town. Mia Larger, Sharon Lobaugh, Jackie Manning, me, Nell McConaughey, Sherry McDonald, Michelle Morrell, Ellen Monroe, Reach Artists at the Canvas, David Riccio, Phoebe Rohrbacher, Charles Rohrbacher, Paul Sargent, Jerry Smitzer, Jane Stokes, Chris Taylor, James Volkers, Tasha Wallen, Arnie Weimer, David Woody, and potentially others.
Is there going to be a map, like a kind of treasure map?
basically, I looked for a map, and I don't think there will be a map, but there will be instructions in the brochure that says if it's in the town or the valley, and in case there's a place that's really difficult to find, like maybe Neil McConaughey's studio, it's 14 Mile, and you take the first left after the ferry terminal. So there will be some direction for artists. And actually, there's two artists, and I don't think I read their names off, but Julie and Kent Crabtree. He wrote to me this morning, and he said he's not sure if anyone will take an hour-long walk to their studio in mid-October, but I think that they live in, or their studio is in a pretty remote place on Douglas Island.
I'll say it's kind of remote. is this a fundraiser at all, or is this all free?
It's all free, and it's the first year, so it's being done without grants. So basically, the brochure is going to be in black and white. Artists are making their own art cards, and there's no fundraiser. But maybe next year, or if it grows, we can look at maybe getting grants for advertising or creating a really nice color brochure.
Sounds like an incredible idea. Thank you very much for working on it and putting it together.
Oh, thank you.
If people need more information about it, is there a number they can call?
I guess they can call me, and my home number is 586-9540.
All right, Pua Manu and Sarah Connor, anything you'd like to add? I might have forgotten to ask.
No, but come to the Open Studios. I think it will be a really exciting event. There's not only two-dimensional artwork, but also three-dimensional, some ceramics, and someone's doing a looping animation video, and so there'll be lots to look at.
And just make sure you mark your calendar for October, Saturday, and Sunday afternoons to go mill around in people's personal spaces.
Mm-hmm. And make sure you mark your calendar for Friday, October 7th, over the First Friday Gallery Walk, where all this will be starting. Thank you very much for coming down to the station.
Okay, thank you, Jeff.
Thanks for having us.
Looking at me, I said, oh no, what's she gonna do? You got enough for one, you got enough for two. I got enough for me, yes, that's true. If I got enough for me, I guess I got enough for you. Come on in.
Thank you.
We were sitting down to eat, just about to begin. There was a knock on the door, said,
can I come in?
Opened up the door. What did I see? It was a great big bear that was looking. I said, oh no, what you gonna do? You got enough for one, you got enough for two. I got enough for me, yes that's true. If I got enough for me, I guess I got enough for you. Come on in, there's not room for anybody else. Come on in.
Thanks a lot.
We were sitting down to eat, just about to begin. Another knock on the door said,
could I come in?
Opened up the door, what did I see? It was a great big lion that was looking at me. I said, whoa, no, what you gonna do? You got enough for one, you got enough for two. I got enough for me, yes, that's true. If I got enough for me, I guess I got enough for you. No room for anybody else. Come on in, there's no room, no, no, no. We were sitting down to eat, just about to begin. Another knock on the door said,
can I come in?
Opened up the door, what did I see? It was a hairy gorilla that was looking at me. I said, oh no, what's she gonna do? You got enough for one, you got enough for two. I got enough for me, yes, that's true. Got enough for me, I guess I got enough for you. There's no room for anybody else. I hope nobody comes to that door. No, no, no. We were sitting down to eat.
It's music by Bill Harley. The time is 3:43, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guest here to talk about last week's Expo, Southeast Alaska Disaster Preparedness Expo. Tom Matisse is in the studio. He's also general manager of KTOO. Bill is here. Thank you very much for coming down the station, everybody.
Hi, Jeff. Thanks for having us.
Well, definitely. Thanks.
So that was some event you did last Friday and Saturday, Tom.
Yeah, we had great turnout. We were really thrilled with all the number of people that came by.
But how many people do you think?
You know, we had roughly 1,000-plus people through the doors, but we weren't doing a good head count, so that's kind of a rough estimate. But due to the feedback cards we got and the raffle drawing numbers we got, that's happy to see it.
For those of you who missed it, could you describe what the expo was all about?
Oh, the Southeast Alaska Preparedness Expo had exhibit-style booths in the main hall with subject matter experts to be able to teach people a little more about all kinds of preparedness, and then tons of lectures in the presentation rooms where we talked about the different disasters in Juneau and the different ways we attack those problems and how the community works together to support them. So it was teaching people a little bit about how to become better prepared and support the community.
I know the two workshops I went to were jam-packed full of people wanting to know more about survival food.
Most definitely. And that's one of the things that we really pushed is teaching people about those 7-day kits and having even more stockpiles on hand. Never a bad thing. It's your food bank account.
About how many workshops and presentations were there?
There were 32 lectures, and we rotated them throughout the 2 days, so pretty full.
And what workshops do you think drew the most attention?
You know, it seemed that the foods one did get the most attention. I mean, everybody has a little bit of food at home, but when you start talking about 7 days, 10 days, a month, people want to know better ideas on what stores well, what keeps well, what kind of things taste good and they like to eat that keep well. So it seemed to draw a lot of attention.
Speaking of eating, I wonder what vendors got the most attention by the menu that they served?
Well, there wasn't a lot of food served, but I know I sampled candy from every dish in the hall.
Phyllis, you're also in the studio with us to tell us about a Radio in a Box program.
Sure. Yeah, we were proud to exhibit and actually unveil the specialized equipment that Coast Alaska has developed. It's to replace the equipment at a radio station if a station was struck by a disaster or had an emergency. So if a studio building, you know, was flooded or had a fire or a transmitter, a tower fell down, we now have portable equipment that we could send any place in Southeast. We have two complete radio stations to go. They come in 4 carrying cases, one with an antenna and a mast to put up the antenna, one with the equivalent of a very small radio studio with CD players, one with a transmitter, and then a roll-around case with accessories like microphones and tape recorders. And these could actually replace an entire radio station in an emergency. So there's going to be one of them stored here in Juneau and one in another community in Southeast Alaska. And as far as we know, it's the first of the kind in the country. It was an idea of Molly Kablers, who's the director of Coast Alaska, and developed by the Coast Alaska engineering team. And it's really pretty cool. It's one person can carry the equipment, and one person could set it up in about a half hour, 45 minutes, and be on the air.
And Brian Zidlaw and John Conar, KTOO engineers and Coast Alaska engineers, help put it all together.
Yep. And it's all equipment that can be flown in a helicopter or on Alaska Airlines or put on a pickup truck on the ferry and delivered, really quickly and set up quickly. So if any of our communities was struck by a disaster that wiped out the local radio station, we'd be ready to go.
It could go in the back of a Subaru.
Almost. The antenna's a little long for a Subaru.
Okay, on top.
On top, yeah. So it'd be like an extra long pair of skis.
And you've got a big blue box with you in the studio.
Yeah,
today.
We at our booth, at the KTOO booth with the radio in a box, we offered people a chance to win an emergency radio, crank-up emergency radio. We actually have 3 of these we're going to draw for, and Tom's going to pick the names. But it's our belief that every home should have a battery-operated radio with that tunes the National Weather Service radio stations, with the NOAA weather radio, so that you can hear emergency announcements on the local radio stations, and you can tune into weather information. So to help promote that, we're giving away 3 NPR emergency radios. These are radios that run on rechargeable batteries, regular batteries, or have a hand crank, so you can crank it up. It's got a weather band on it, so you can hear any one of the 7 weather channels. And it's got a flashlight and a siren built into it, so if you were trapped, you could, signal for help with the siren or the flashlight. So we got 3 of these. Tom, you want to draw, and I'll read the names here. Let's do, there's the rattling of the paper. We'll do number 1 here is, looks like Delfina Gillanese. So we'll call Delfina and get the radio to her. One more.
And these are all people that went to the Preparedness Expo last weekend.
They stopped by our booth. Tanya Kay is the next winner. Congratulations, Tanya. You'll get an NPR emergency radio. And the third and final winner is, looks like Dustin. Can you read that?
I believe that's Chatham Holt.
Chatham Holt. Okay, congratulations to Chatham Holt, Deanna Gillaries, and Tanya Kay. And we'll get in touch with you and make sure you get your NPR emergency radio.
Thank you, Bill. And Tom, as long as you're here, you want to talk about winter weather preparedness?
Oh, well, winter weather is coming our way, so it's good to have everything strapped down and know that your roofing is in good order and know that your outside propane tanks are strapped to their frames if need be, and be thinking about the weather that's to come. You know, we're going to see a lot of snow, a lot of wind, and here comes winter. We're looking forward to it.
And I heard on the news today that the roof of the Alaska Airlines cargo terminal in Petersburg blew off last week during that big blow. So seems like it's coming early, Jeff.
Tony, I want to mention that website from the U.S. government that talks to people about being ready in case of a disaster.
Ready.gov. It's a great, great website. Lots of information available.
And anything you'd like to add, I might have forgotten to ask.
No, thanks again for having us down. You know, the emergency alert system and the radio stations play such a huge part in that. So it was great to see your radios in a box and great to see you guys handing out alert warning radios. And thanks so much for being a big part of it.
Thank you and all the volunteers that took part in the event.
Thanks, Joe. We'll be right back.
sister and by the hand. Lead her away from this foreign land. Far away, where we'll not laugh again. We are leaving, you know, near. South on my shoulder, I guess I'll set a course and go.
This is Bird Note. From our land-based perspective, birds appear to fly fairly low, and for much of the year, birds stick to under 500 feet. That's where food and shelter await them, and there's no reason to expend the energy to wing skyward. However, during migration, there is good reason for birds to gain altitude, and many species fly at 2,000 to 5,000 feet, where they can use the prevailing winds to assist them on their way. On a long-distance flight, a bird may begin travel at about 5,000 feet and then slowly climb to 20,000 feet. Like a jet plane that can fly higher as it uses up fuel, birds can fly higher as they become lighter. One record for high-altitude flight was a flock of swans over Northern Ireland, visually identified by a pilot cruising at 29,000 feet. But the all-time record for highest flying bird goes to a vulture with a 10-foot wingspan called a Ruppell's griffin. The bird, unfortunately, was sucked into a jet engine at 37,900 feet. That's more than a mile and a half higher than the summit of Mount Everest. Bird Note is independently produced by the nonprofit Tune Into Nature. To learn more, come to birdnote.org.
Support for programming on this station is provided by Jesse Keel, candidate for Juneau Assembly District 1, paid for by Keel for Assembly, Harvey Marvin and Margaret Pugh co-chairs, 535 Harris Street, Juneau.
Time is 3:58, and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. KTOO broadcasts at 104.3 FM in Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Occupy area, tuned to K276AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Switzer Creek, K269AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201AM 88.1. K220BT serves Hoonah at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210AS 89.9. And in Juneau, you can also receive KTOO on GCI Cable Juneau on Digital Channel 871. We're also online at www.ktoo.org. Tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon, Pat Moore will be your guest host. He'll talk with organizers for the upcoming sale auction. Paul Carroll will give us a preview of his talk on Wednesday on U.S. nuclear policy, and we'll get some insight into the Low Vision Support Group with guests Cheryl Putnam and Dale Wygant. We'll also learn about the Jewish Community Charter School's upcoming trips to Denali and Fairbanks. Then Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music and More tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon with your guest Pat Moore, your guest host Pat Moore. With the forecast for tonight, cloudy skies with a slight chance of rain later on, low temperatures around 42 degrees. Forecast for Tuesday, cloudy skies with a chance of rain in the morning, then scattered showers in the afternoon with high temperatures around 55 degrees. Coming up next is All Things Considered. Thank you for tuning in to Juno Afternoon today. Have a great evening.